The original podcast was recorded in German. This podcast was translated using artificial intelligence. Burn Rate, the Venture Insider podcast with Max Meister.
Welcome to Burn Rate, the VC Insider podcast. I'm here with Guy Jafredi to talk about the startup scene with a special focus on venture capital. This is episode 59, recorded on Thursday, August 21st at 9 p.m. As always, the show is supported by our sponsors, Wengert Vieli and the Bern Economic Development Agency. Guy, what's on the agenda today?
Quite a lot, actually. In the news, we'll start with a negative record, the number of Swiss startup liquidations in the first half of 2025. Then we'll talk about the upcoming billion franc exit of uBlox and the return of US VCs to the European market. Our deep dive features Lucas Mittelmeier from Heal Capital, who will explain how they use a voice bot as the first touchpoint for startups applying for funding. I'm really looking forward to that. We've also got a listener question about whether it makes sense for founders to issue voting rights shares. And at the end, we'll give a quick roundup of all the recent deals in the Swiss startup ecosystem since our last episode.
Sounds great. Let's kick off with the news. According to Startup Ticker, the number of Swiss startups shutting down in the first half of the year has hit an all-time high. 65 companies closed more than ever before in a comparable period. What stands out is that almost half of them were at a very early stage, before or just after their first funding rounds. It shows how tough today's market conditions are for young companies. But here's the paradox. While more startups are shutting down, total funding volume has actually jumped to 1.47 billion francs, up 36% from last year. The catch is that the money is going into far fewer deals, mostly into established scale-ups with proven models. So on the one hand, many young companies are dying early. On the other, a lot of capital is being concentrated in a small number of big bets. That raises a question for the ecosystem. Are we losing breadth? And with it, innovation. At the same time, this trend mirrors the global picture. Fewer deals overall, but larger rounds. So Guy, how do you explain this record number of liquidations in Switzerland? Is it mainly a post-boom correction or something deeper?
Honestly, I don't think it's as bad as the headline sounds. In Switzerland, startups are often kept alive for a long time with follow-on funding from existing investors, even when it's pretty clear there won't be a venture return. Maybe you get your capital back if you're lucky. The rule of thumb is 1 out of 10 startups becomes a big success, 3 can be sold for something, and about half get written off or sold in a fire sale. We're nowhere near that extreme. To me, this looks like a correction from the boom years. Back then, there was way too much money in the market and people invested too broadly without asking if a company was really venture grade. Many of those startups never got real traction, even after multiple bridge rounds. Now investors are simply deciding not to put more money in. The ones being liquidated never made the transition toward profitability or into SME territory, so investors bit the bullet and pulled the plug.
Right. But at the same time, more capital is flowing into fewer deals. Do you see that as a sign of maturity in the ecosystem or a risk that the next generation of startups won't get a fair chance?
It's more like a pendulum swing. During the boom years, it was spray and pray. Now it's the opposite. Concentrated bets on a very small number of high-quality deals, ideally with strong syndicates to maximize survival chances. I don't think this extreme focus will last forever. But in today's tough environment, where people are actually taking write-offs and marking investments down to zero, investors are learning a lot. That always happens in downturns. Overall, I'm not worried about the breadth of the ecosystem, especially at the very early stage, pre-seed and seed. I think Switzerland still has plenty of capital available for startups.
All right, let's turn to a success story. ETH spin-off uBlox, which develops high-precision navigation and IoT solutions, is about to hit a major milestone. US private equity firm Advent International plans to acquire the company in an all-cash deal worth around 1.05 billion Swiss francs. That's a 53% premium over the weighted average share price of the past 6 months. The deal will be done through Advent subsidiary Zenith and is expected to close within 6 months, pending regulatory approvals. Management is on board, and the largest shareholder with about 9% has also agreed to sell. For uBlox, it's a big win. In 2024, they cut losses significantly and sharpened their focus on navigation and positioning for automotive, robotics, and agriculture by selling off their cellular module unit. In short, an ETH spin-off turned unicorn, proof that Swiss deep tech can compete globally. Guy, what makes this exit so noteworthy aside from the billion-franc price tag? Was it the strategic focus and market position, or was it more about timing and improved conditions for PE deals?
It's definitely a blockbuster deal for Switzerland, but also a little bittersweet. uBlocks is a top Swiss company listed on the local exchange, and now it's being snapped up by an American player. Chips are a strategic resource these days, so losing one of our leaders stings. If you look at the market, semiconductor giants like Arm, Nvidia, AMD, and Qualcomm have all seen massive stock price gains recently. It's only natural that large PE funds like Advent are looking to acquire smaller players, especially those close to profitability. uBlocks' decision to focus on profitable business areas certainly made it more attractive. And under Advent, the company is expected to finally hit profitability next year.
uBlocks is a textbook example of a successful ETH spin-off. What does this deal mean for Switzerland's deep tech scene? Do you think it boosts confidence and inspires more founders at ETH and other universities?
Absolutely. A billion franc exit in something as complex as semiconductors is a huge achievement and strengthens Switzerland's position. Whether it inspires more ETH graduates to start companies, I'm not sure. That entrepreneurial drive is already strong. But it will definitely boost investor confidence both nationally and internationally. And I'm sure we'll see this exit pop up in a lot of pitch decks in the years to come.
All right, let's move on to our last news item today, which is an exciting development in the European VC market. US investors are back and in full force. According to PitchBook data, in the first half of 2025, US investors participated in 22% of all European financing rounds. That's more than 1,000 deals, 1,081 to be exact, the highest level since 2022. This trend is especially visible in AI. Sifted reports that in the first 6 months of this year, the number of US VCs making at least two AI investments in Europe jumped by 73% compared to last year. In other words, the big Silicon Valley players are actively hunting for European gems, particularly in deep tech and AI. So here's the big question for Europe. Are our startups truly benefiting from this influx of capital, or does it increase their dependence on foreign money? And what does it mean for local funds that are competing for the best deals? Guy, how do you see this? Is the US return more of a vote of confidence in Europe, or a tactical move to secure early access to AI opportunities on this side of the Atlantic, or maybe both?
For me, it's clearly a bit of both. On the one hand, it's definitely a sign of confidence. The big US funds invest very selectively and only where they see the potential for massive exits. And Europe, especially in deep tech and AI, has outstanding founder teams with strong scientific foundations. On the other hand, they also want to get in early, secure a seat at the table before valuations rise sharply in later rounds. And we shouldn't forget, these top-tier funds have enormous capital reserves, which we simply don't have in Europe. For them, Europe is an attractive hunting ground. And for the best European startups, it's also an opportunity to raise bigger rounds and compete internationally with the scale of US deals. And maybe there's even a geopolitical element here, big US funds diversifying beyond their home market.
And what about European funds? What does this mean for them? Do they need to specialize more to stay competitive with their US counterparts? Or do you also see opportunities for cooperation?
I actually see plenty of opportunities for collaboration. Many US funds don't really want to operate in Europe on their own. They lack proximity to the market and often don't know the regulatory environments well enough. So they're actively looking for local partners who understand the deal flow and can support founders on the ground. European funds with strong networks can really benefit by acting as bridge builders. That said, competition will intensify. European funds will more often be outbid by the larger checks and higher valuations US VCs are willing to pay. So local funds will need to adapt, move faster, take more risk, and maybe even rethink the size of their funds to stay in the game.
Wenger Veely, your partner law firm for startups, whether it's incorporation, a financing round, or an exit, Startups face complex legal challenges. Wenger Vili supports founders at every stage of their journey with tailored advice on corporate law, financing, tax, and IP protection. Wenger Vili, your legal advisors for startups. This podcast is also supported by the Bern Economic Development Agency. Whether you're founding a company or relocating to the canton of Bern, the agency provides advisory and funding support to strengthen the region's business environment.
All right, let's get to today's deep dive. We're looking at how artificial intelligence is changing the VC process. Specifically, we'll discuss an example out of Berlin. Heal Capital has taken a bold approach by replacing the first intro call with a voice bot. Instead of pitching to an investor right away, startups first pitch to the bot. The idea is to improve efficiency and fairness. The bot can take pitches anytime, removing scheduling friction, and it helps systematically and objectively filter which founders get a second meeting. This way, the fund can hear from many more startups, save time, and perhaps reduce unconscious bias in the selection process. Of course, there are open questions. Can AI really capture the passion and personality of a founding team? Does standardization risk filtering out creativity? And how do founders react when their first pitch isn't to a human but to a machine? We're going to explore all of that today with our guest, Lucas Mittelmeier from Heal Capital. Lucas, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
To kick things off, what led Heal Capital to introduce the voice bot as the first screening step? What's the main goal behind it?
At the core, we just like experimenting with AI. I think as investors, it's our job to stay close to new developments and try things out. This was one of many experiments we've done. The goal is always the same: become more efficient, save time, and hand off repetitive tasks to AI once you trust it. In this specific case, we also wanted better and more relevant information from each startup. Everyone knows the standard submit your pitch online forms where founders just fill in the same fields. Our idea was to go deeper, capture more nuance about each startup and get more detail than a form could provide.
That sounds exciting. But how do you address the risk of bias in the voice bot, especially with founder diversity? I'm thinking about things like accents or dialects. For example, I don't speak perfect high German myself, and in English someone might sound very different depending on whether they're from Manchester or Texas. How do you make sure that doesn't become a problem?
Good question. We've only been using it for about 4 months, so the data set isn't big enough yet to draw firm conclusions, but we've already taken steps to prevent it from becoming an issue. First, the underlying technology is improving quickly. We use 11labs voice suite, and when we started, you could only launch the bot in one language. Now it can switch between multiple languages during a conversation and handle a wide range of accents and dialects. So thankfully, the tech is getting better all the time, lowering that barrier. And honestly, I'd even say the bot might reduce bias. When a human sits across from another human, you automatically perceive things like ethnicity or gender, and that can trigger bias. With the bot, those cues are absent. I recently came across a study in recruiting that compared humans with bots, and they actually found less bias on the bot side. So my hope is that we'll see less bias with the voice bot than with human screeners. Though, of course, we can't prove that yet.
That's fascinating. And are you training the bot with any internal models or just adapting existing tools like 11labs to pitch content?
We don't train our own models. That would be unrealistic. We're a 7-person team. We don't have the resources. And frankly, it would be wasted effort. The technology is moving too fast and you'd immediately fall behind commercial tools. It's similar to when funds used to build their own scraping or sourcing tools. Most have realized by now that commercial solutions quickly outpace them. So our focus is 100% on making the application work well, integrating it smoothly into our processes, fine-tuning the prompts, and setting up a clear data set that reflects our scope, what we look for, what we don't, and which questions matter most. In other words, it's all about prompt engineering and application design, not building models from scratch.
Maybe you can give us one or two examples where the AI actually delivered surprising insights, either unexpectedly positive or just something you didn't anticipate.
Yes, two things stood out to me. First, I was surprised by how good the AI is at picking up on commercial aspects of a business model. Honestly, I didn't expect that. If we had, say, an intern doing the first screening, the questions probably wouldn't be as sharp or specific. But with the right prompting, the bot can go surprisingly deep into business model details. Second, I've been impressed by how openly founders speak to the bot. Many talk with real passion about their background and why they're building their company. In some ways, the bot is a better listener. It doesn't interrupt, doesn't try to fix things. It just asks and listens. That creates space for founders to share more. Of course, this can also be a downside because large language models aren't naturally very critical.
And how are founders reacting overall? You mentioned it briefly earlier, but do they see this as an efficiency gain, or do some feel less personally involved and push back against the idea?
That was definitely our biggest concern. That's why in our experiment, we made the process optional. Founders could either send us a pitch deck or use the voice bot. What we've seen is that around 25% chose to try the bot, and those who did generally gave us very positive feedback. Others weren't interested. They didn't have time, or they just weren't comfortable with the idea. Some think it's pointless. So I'd say it's a love it or hate it thing. That's why we'll keep it optional. For those who enjoy it and see value, it's a great tool. For those who don't, they can stick to the traditional way.
That's really interesting. We usually tell founders to get to a personal conversation as quickly as possible to create that human connection. A voice bot could feel like an extra hurdle, but if it's optional, that's fine. Let's talk KPIs. You've been running this for 4 months. Do you have any metrics yet on how effective the bot is compared to traditional calls? Things like conversion rates, lead quality, or time savings?
We only have indicative numbers so far, but they're already interesting. On average, successful calls with the bot run about 6 to 7 minutes. We cap the time so people don't drive up inference costs. It's designed to be a short, structured first touch point. We've also seen that founders who go through the bot are actually more likely to get a follow-up call with our team than those who only submit a deck. Part of that is probably novelty bias. It's still new and exciting for us. But it's also because the bot collects more information than a deck alone, which lowers the threshold for us to schedule a real conversation. So in a way, instead of being a hurdle, the bot has actually increased access to the next step.
So the lead quality is higher, but the time savings are less clear because you end up doing more calls you might not otherwise have done. Interesting. Do you see the voice bot as just a temporary experiment or as a permanent part of your VC process going forward? And how does it tie into your existing tools like your website form or internal processes?
The key lesson for us has been integration is everything. If you don't integrate properly, the best tech won't help. It will just waste time and frustrate the team. So our focus has been making sure it works seamlessly in our workflow. And that's still evolving. I think the bot will remain part of our process long term, but in a specific role. We're not going to make every single team pitch the bot. That would be silly, especially if we already know them. But for inbound, where you get a flood of unfiltered requests, it's very useful. I even put the bot on my LinkedIn profile. LinkedIn messages are messy and hard to filter, so now founders can just go straight to the bot. On our website, we already have a structured process, but LinkedIn wasn't built for that. So in that context, the bot really helps. We'll see how long it stays in that role or if it evolves into something bigger.
And in terms of quality control, do you have a human in the loop? How do you make sure the bot is fair, accurate, and reliable in its assessments?
Yes, absolutely. The bot never makes decisions on its own. It runs the conversation autonomously, asking questions, gathering answers. But at the end, it summarizes everything in bullet points with contact details and sends it to me like a colleague passing on notes. I can review it on my phone and from there decide whether to set up a call or not. And to make sure nothing slips through, I sometimes listen to the raw recordings, especially if something went wrong, like someone's mic wasn't working or the conversation dropped. That way I can check if it was a tech issue rather than the founder's fault. So yes, the bot handles the heavy lifting, but the decision-making is firmly human.
Final question, let's flip the perspective. If you were a founder and a VC you really wanted to talk to, offered you two options, pitch to their voice bot or directly to the investment team, what would you choose? And
if I had a direct connection to a VC I knew or a warm intro, of course I'd always go to the human first. That won't change. But if I didn't know the fund well or I wanted a quick, low-barrier way to get on their radar, I'd happily use the bot. In fact, I'd recommend founders try it. It can be a surprisingly effective way to get noticed. And I can guarantee this. If someone pitches through my bot, they'll get a faster response from me than if they just message me on LinkedIn.
That's a great point. Lucas, thank you so much for joining us on Burn Rate. We'll be following Heal Capital and your voice bot experiment closely and wish you all the best.
Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure being here.
All right, let's move on to today's listener question. This one comes from Lucas in Basel. He asks whether it makes sense for founders in Switzerland to introduce voting rights shares. Let's take a quick look at the legal side first. Under Swiss corporate law, voting rights shares are explicitly allowed. The key point is that the nominal value of these shares must be no more than 1/10 of the nominal value of the ordinary shares. That creates a leverage effect. Founders can hold relatively little capital, but still maintain greater voting power. It's a useful tool, but not as flexible as in other jurisdictions. In the US, for example, dual class share structures are very common, especially in tech. Think of Google, Meta, or Airbnb. Their founders hold so-called supervoting shares that carry 10, 20, or even 100 times the voting rights of regular shares. That way, even if they get heavily diluted economically, they can still maintain control of board votes and elections. This is especially relevant at IPO because founders don't want to give up control when they go public. Switzerland is more restrictive. Here, voting rights can only be adjusted through the nominal value structure, not through freely defined multiple vote shares. So the possibilities are limited, but for founders, it remains an important instrument to maintain control as financing rounds grow. The real question is, do voting rights shares actually benefit startups, or do they make fundraising harder because investors expect more influence? Guy, as an investor, what's your take? Speaker 2. Well, anything that's unusual is at least a bit of a red flag, especially in early stage investing. And voting rights shares in the startup world are very unusual. We've looked at hundreds of Swiss deals over the years, and I can only think of one recent exit that actually involved voting rights shares. That's how rare it is. Normally, control in Swiss startups is determined by valuation and dilution over the course of financing rounds. From a founder's perspective, of course, voting rights shares are a great tool to keep control. But from an investor's side, I'm paying a valuation far above nominal value, and I expect to have a say in return. So if a startup shows up with voting rights shares, I immediately ask why. Maybe there's a good reason and we can talk about it. But my first reaction is caution. It can feel like founders just want money without investor involvement. That's not very attractive to me. That said, there can be valid use cases. For example, if a startup is still very early, needs a lot of capital, and investors are pushing for a low valuation, founders could use voting rights shares to maintain strategic control, even if they're diluted economically. It can be a temporary balance until later investors accept the structure. But overall, I'd call it an orange flag. So Max, let me turn it back to you. Looking at later stages, an exit or IPO, do you see voting rights shares as more of a shield for founders or a potential obstacle down the line? Speaker 1. It's a great question. If you look at the US, voting rights shares were introduced and pushed by some of the top VCs, people like Mark Andreessen or Michael Moritz at Sequoia. At Google, for example, they argued it was essential to keep Larry Page in control for the long-term vision. That logic has also played out at Snap with Evan Spiegel or at Meta with Mark Zuckerberg. In those cases, the founders really were central to the company's success. But the opposite risk exists. What if a founder turns into a lame duck and underperforms? Then you're stuck with them and it's very hard to change leadership. That's why it's a double-edged sword. In Switzerland, the principle is one share, one vote. Investors here expect equal rights if they put in capital. That makes fundraising with voting rights shares trickier. Still, for founders, it can be a useful shield early on, keeping decision-making power even when investors bring more money to the table. It helps protect long-term vision from being overridden by short-term financial interests. But at later stages, exits or IPOs, complex share structures can definitely be a stumbling block. Many acquirers and public market investors prefer simple, transparent governance. Dual-class shares are common in the US but much less accepted in Europe. So Lucas, the short answer is, yes, you can introduce voting rights shares in Switzerland, but you should expect pushback. If you use them, consider time-limiting the structure, say 5 or 10 years, or committing to revisit it later with investors. Otherwise, what helps you in the early phase could hurt you in the exit phase. All right, let's wrap up with the deals of the week. Since our last episode, we've seen 63 million francs raised and 2 exits completed. First up, Babylon Biotech in Schlieren near Zurich raised 30 million francs.
The company develops human-derived antibodies for allergy treatment, currently focused on peanut allergies.
The round was led by former Roche executives and board members.
The funding will cover phase 1 A and 1B trials through 2027, and help expand their pipeline, definitely one to watch for allergy sufferers.
Next, Inkivo Technologies, an ETH spin-off in Ticino, raised $1.1 million in a pre-seed round.
They're building a novel formulation platform to make drugs more effective and longer-lasting. Their lead program targets anemia.
The round was led by TI Ventures and Claves Investments, plus Angels. Third, Reconnect Labs emerged from stealth with more than 22 million francs in funding.
They're aiming to transform psychiatry with AI-driven regenerative therapies for PTSD, addiction, and anxiety. Two candidates are already in phase two trials.
Funding included 12 million in equity and 10 million in grants.
Their approach combines AI-based patient stratification, reformulation of existing drugs, and clinical data with the goal of restoring mental balance rather than just suppressing symptoms.
Switching to AgTech, Green Transfer from Valet raised 450,000 francs.
It's an app that digitizes orders and invoicing for local farmers, winemakers, cheesemakers, and butchers, giving them more time for their craft and less for admin.
The round included private investors and support from the ARC Innovation Campus.
The funds will go toward product launch, new features like bank integration, and boosting local sales.
In logistics, Swiss Airtainer teamed up with Envirotainer, a Swedish pharma transport leader.
Swiss Airtainer builds the world's lightest actively cooled air freight container with solar panels and real-time monitoring to secure the cold chain for medicines. Envirotainer now has exclusive global distribution rights.
Next, Zurich-based Vulpo raised 8.8 million in a Series A.
It's an edtech platform offering AI-supported, curriculum-compliant learning content in seven countries, from primary to high school.
Investors included family offices and well-known names like Peter Waffley, Bruno Pfister, Dario Faslik, and even footballer Jan Sommer.
The funds will go into product development, adding adaptive learning paths, gamification, and school challenges.
Finally, Appenzell-based Sparkleys closed a round with Brewery Locker as a strategic partner.
Sparkleys, known for its vegan hard seltzers, is launching Sparkly Soda, a fruit-based soft drink with fiber. Locker will handle production and distribution, enabling national expansion.
On the exit side, Crypto Fund News, a Zurich-based portal for crypto hedge fund news, was acquired by Crypto Funds Watch from Miami.
Together, they'll become a leading info source for institutional crypto investors.
And in coffee, Lucerne-based McAfee, developer of a compact tabletop coffee roaster, was acquired by Thermoplan.
Thermoplan was already an investor and now plans to bring the roaster to market, debuting it at the Host Fair in Milan this October. Strategically, it lets them offer the entire bean-to-cup journey.
That's it for this week's Burn Rate, the VC Insider podcast. If you'd like to support us, subscribe to our newsletter and share it with your network. Thanks for tuning in. We wish you a great weekend. Take care and goodbye.